Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hi, everybody. Patrick here. Today, we're going to revisit one of my favorite older episodes for you to listen to. So, when we think of the Middle Ages, the first thing that comes to mind is usually knights in shining armor, guided by the ideal of chivalry. But what was chivalry? It certainly wasn't some romantic idea of honor and bravery. We're going to explore what chivalry actually was, how it molded and shaped knights and their behavior, and what it really meant to be a knight in the Middle Ages. Thanks for joining me today, and enjoy the show.
A young knight sat sweating on his horse, lance at the ready. A crowd had gathered to watch. The only sounds our young knight heard through the thin slits in his helmet were the distant chatter of the crowd and the sound of his own heart pounding in his chest. His horse whinnied and pawed at the ground, ready to sprint. Every shift from the knight or his horse ground armor plates against one another. The lance grew heavier in his hand with every passing second. 100 feet away, another knight, lance in hand, stared straight back at him. The young knight turned to peer toward the crowd. A wooden pavilion held richly dressed attendees. Lords, ladies, and other knights drank wine in the sun. Minstrels plucked their lutes and sang long, winding ballads of love and great deeds. The crowd settled. All eyes turned toward the knights. The air was electric with anticipation. A pair of heralds, bedecked in arms, read out each knight's lineage and named their proud forebears who had held expansive lands, great titles of lordship, and done great deeds. The young knight took deep breaths and tried to slow his racing heart. He was just a teenager. This was his first joust in front of an audience this big, or any audience for that matter. If he lost, he could lose his horse, his money, maybe even his life. But if he won, he could win big. High status, honor, material goods, all would flow to him. He could see the king, the sponsor of the tournament, addressing the crowd. But through the thick padding around his head and his helmet, he couldn't hear what he was saying. But then the king gestured to the knights. Our young friend knew exactly what that meant. He spurred his horse at the same time his opponent did. The knights rode straight for each other, lances out in front. The horse's hooves thundered on the ground. The impact of every step across the churned dirt field sent reverberations through the knight's armor. He saw his opponent getting closer and closer and closer until finally, the young knight felt his opponent's lance shatter off his shield. He was almost thrown from his horse, but he held on. A split second later, his thrust had been better. It caught his opponent square in the chest and sent him flying backwards. He had won. The crowd went wild. But the young knight could barely hear them. The blood was still ringing in his ears beneath his helmet. His arms and his shoulders ached from his blow and his opponent's. But he forgot the pain. He had won, and he would reap the rewards. Everybody in the crowd would know his name. He had shown off his prowess. He was on his way to true chivalry. Chivalry. It's one of the defining features of the Middle Ages. Today, we're going to find out what it really meant. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. When we think of the Middle Ages, one of the first things that come to mind are knights in shining armor. They are the foundational pop culture expectation of what the whole period looked like. Gloriously bedecked men on horseback, kitted out in gleaming metal plates, wearing brightly colored surcoats, holding swords and lances. It's a powerful image, and it's still all over movies and TV, from Braveheart and A Knight's Tale to Game of Thrones, where the general picture has a thin veneer of fantasy painted over the top. The public's obsession with chivalric knights reaches back into the 19th century craze for the medieval, with popular authors like Mark Twain and Sir Walter Scott, among many, many, many others. On this basis, we might think that we have a clear idea of what chivalry meant. a stiff code of behavior for respectable, aristocratic warriors who melded honorable warfare with deep piety and the enthusiastic pursuit of courtly love. But that's a highly misleading and essentially modern portrayal. Knights did exist, and even more than that, they dominated medieval society. In really essential ways, the aristocracy of the Middle Ages, the secular elite, was a military aristocracy. The military function of kings, dukes, counts, all the way down to knights with an individual plot of land, was essential to justifying their control over society. Even more than that, it defined how that elite thought about themselves and their role. They talked about knights and knighthood among themselves. They wrote books about it. They consumed literature that prominently featured knighthood. We can call that set of ideas and practices chivalry. Chivalry and its broader meanings are what we'll talk about here on today's episode. There are three major components to that. First, the ideal that participants in this knightly culture put out into the world. Second, the reality of the behavior of knights and how they did or didn't live up to that ideal. And finally, how those things changed over time. To help us understand all this, we'll dig into the life of a hypothetical knight. We'll name him Jean. So let's start with the world itself. What do we mean when we say chivalry? The key thing to understand is that chivalry was a word that medieval people used themselves. It's not an outside imposition, a term that we've come up with in the present to define something in the past, like feudalism. Feudalism is a good example of that. But that doesn't necessarily make chivalry easier to define. On the contrary, when medieval people said chivalry, they could mean a number of different things. The historian Richard Kuiper breaks them down nicely. So first, chivalry could mean deeds of notable valor on a battlefield. If a knight went around a battlefield hacking off limbs and heads in full view of his comrades, then that knight had done chivalry. Second, chivalry could mean a collective body of knights. If an author during the Hundred Years' War, for example, talked about the chivalry of France, that meant the arms-bearing knights of France, not how chivalrous they were. Finally, and this is the sense we're most familiar with, chivalry could actually refer to a series of formative concepts, an ideology. When somebody talks about a quote-unquote chivalric code or says, oh, chivalry is dead, this is what they mean. Now, it shouldn't be surprising that medieval people didn't have one single idea of what that meant. It's not like somebody wrote out what chivalry meant as a code of behavior, and then everybody either followed that idea or deviated from it. Instead, chivalry was often fluid and amorphous. It was a subject of debate and disagreement, even back then. Many of the things that we might think of as hallmarks of chivalry were actually attempts from outside reformers to impose change on a violent bunch of knights. And yet, there was some broad agreement on what chivalry meant, even across boundaries of language, ethnicity, and political affiliation. In terms of basic worldview, a German-speaking knight from Saxony might have had a lot in common with a Frenchman or a Castilian. For them, chivalry was a practical set of structures. It was mental signposts for navigating life in a particular class of arms-bearing warriors. There were three essential rules everyone seemed to agree on. First of all, there was prowess. Prowess is just the performance of notable deeds of arms. After all, these were essentially professional warriors of high status. Fighting well was the essence of what made them who they were. Prowess wasn't some sense of abstract moral courage, as the historian Richard Kuiper put it. Instead, it was raw, bloody, physical performance and hand-to-hand combat. It was violence done well. The second agreed-upon concept was honor. This can be a bit confusing, but in the medieval context, it was a social possession. It meant holding a certain status in the social hierarchy and asserting that status loudly and proudly. If anybody challenged that holder's claim to status, then honor was to be defended vigorously in that hand-to-hand physical combat that we talked about. The final basic concept was piety. Most knights had no doubt that their place in the world as respected fighters had been ordained by God. God approved of their actions, they fought for good causes, and good fighting would bring heavenly rewards. There might seem to be some contradictions here. Didn't God condemn violence? What honor was there in acts of brutality? But when we wrap our heads around the fact that prowess was the fundamental core of chivalry, we'll see that there was no real conflict between honor or religious piety and the practice of violence. Violence done with the approval of fellow partakers in chivalry was the central planet around which all those other satellites orbited. Prowess vindicated honor. Exercising prowess was in perfect accordance with the world that God had made. So those are the basic outlines of what medieval people meant when they said chivalry. A collective body of knights, outstanding deeds, and a kind of fluid ideal of behavior that revolved around skillful violence. But where did chivalry come from? And what exactly was a knight? The answer to both of those questions lies in the closing years of the early Middle Ages, in the chaotic and confusing years of the 10th and 11th centuries. This is the period when the thing that we call feudalism evolved. The essence of the story is that public power and authority, law, justice, war making, and what have you, devolved from major figures like kings down to the regional and even the local level. Castles popped up all over Western Europe as symbols of the local power of individual lords. Each of these lords had mounted warriors fighting for him. These small-time lords and their retinues of mounted warriors were some cross between a protection racket and a private military force. They fought each other incessantly. Ties of homage, of allegiance, bound mounted warriors to their lords and smaller lords to greater lords. Land and military service became tied together. Now, practically every detail of that story could be and has been argued over, whether feudalism ever actually existed in this schematic form, when and where these mounted warriors emerged, just how violent the society really was, and so on. There are just so few sources for a lot of the 10th and 11th centuries. Depending on what you look at, you can draw really drastically different portraits of the closing years of the early Middle Ages. Historians, naturally enough, have done just that. They've argued with each other incessantly about who's right. It's enough to make your eyes bleed. The question of just when these mounted warriors became quote-unquote knights and when chivalry became a thing is bound up with these debates about feudalism and the broader transformation of medieval society. Really, it's a question of when, where, and how something that we would call classic medieval society took on the form that we understand. Originally, these heavily armored, mounted warriors who were beginning to dominate battlefields during this period didn't belong to an exalted social group. Many of them were even legally unfree in the same way that serfs were later. Over time, though, the practice of mounted, armored warfare began to confer a more elevated social status on its practitioners. We can see this happening over the course of the 11th century. It's clear that these armored warriors were beginning to develop rules and concepts of behavior that governed war among themselves. Those concepts of behavior also reinforced the idea that these mounted warriors weren't just common soldiers. They were a cut above. Religious ideals were also getting wound into these ideas about how mounted warriors were supposed to act, too. The ceremony of dubbing, of formally making someone a knight, appeared here and there. By the opening decades of the 12th century, just after the First Crusade, we can start to see a full fusion of function and ideology. Mounted, armored warriors bound together by a set of ideals about how they were supposed to behave. What's more, those ideals and functions started to spread upward through the social spectrum. Originally, great lords and kings didn't necessarily think of themselves as belonging to this chivalric group. Over the course of the late 11th and 12th centuries, they started to assimilate these values in this military function for themselves. By the beginning of the 13th century, to be the Duke of Aquitaine or the King of France or what have you also meant being a knight. It's not that there weren't still distinctions of status within this group. Nobody was going to confuse a king for some lowly man-at-arms with some rusty armor and a broken-down nag of a horse. But that lowly man-at-arms and that king still shared something essential in terms of their outlook and their values. That is the key point here. That's why chivalry matters so much to understanding the High and the Late Middle Ages. Chivalry guided the behavior of these people and set their priorities. It justified their social domination. From the lowliest knight to the greatest king, chivalry was the lens through which the lay aristocracy, the secular aristocracy, understood the world.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Really understanding the mentalities of people who lived in the past is a difficult task. From the ground up, so many of their basic assumptions about how the world was supposed to work differ from our own in ways that we're usually not aware of. It's far too easy to look back and judge them by standards they wouldn't have recognized or to paint them as hypocrites. Now, of course, this doesn't mean accepting or celebrating all of their behavior as inevitable, just a product of their world. But it is about understanding how they acted and why they acted that way. Chivalry is a prime example of this. From the 19th century on, plenty of folks have held up a largely invented code of chivalry as a mirror to their own times. It serves as a corrective to what they see as shortcomings in modern behavior. But this is an idealized chivalry that bears little or no resemblance to the real thing. On the flip side, plenty of folks have pointed out what seem to be the inherent contradictions between a life centered around violence and the concepts of honor and piety that are supposed to go along with chivalry. That gap between ideal and reality is one of the most compelling thematic elements in Game of Thrones, even if that's set in a fantasy world instead of late medieval Europe proper. But both of those tendencies obscure the realities of chivalry. Words whose meanings seem fairly clear to us, violence, honor, piety, for example, meant very different things to medieval people. Now, this isn't to say that knights always lived up to their ideals, very much the opposite. There was real disagreement about what kind of behavior was, in fact, chivalrous. But it means that there were far fewer contradictions and paradoxes built into this system of chivalry than we might at first think. It means that we need to ditch our stereotypes if we want to properly understand it. The real tensions and contradictions built into chivalry aren't necessarily the ones that we might expect. The best way for us to understand this chivalric mindset as it really existed is to follow the life of a hypothetical knight. We'll call him Jean. Let's say he was born around the year 1330 in Picardy, about 80 miles northeast of Paris in northern France. We've covered this ground before, back in our tour of Europe on the Brink in 1346. This is the territory of the Lord of Coucy, that great white round castle jutting out of the French countryside. Our friend Jean lives in the territory of one of the greatest lords of France, but Jean is no great lord himself. His father, Philippe, is a knight in the Lord of Coucy's household. In return for his military service to the Lord of Coucy, Philippe holds the rights to a small manor house with households of peasants several miles away from the castle. The revenue from this land, the rents squeezed from the peasants, are what allow Philippe to pay for his horse, his armor, and all the other trappings of knightly status. Although he holds that manor from the Lord of Coucy, Philippe spends most of his time in the castle of Coucy. That's the environment in which our friend Jean grows up, surrounded by dozens of other knights, by the practice and the values of chivalry. From the very beginning, Jean learned to ride a horse and wield weapons. Skill at arms and the deeds they allowed a knight to perform was the foundation of chivalry. Jean was on horseback almost as soon as he could walk. He played with toy swords and graduated from there to practice weapons. He learned to wrestle. He practiced jousting religiously.
By his 10th birthday, he could spit a target on the end of his lance at full gallop. As Jean learned the skills that would make him a knight, he absorbed the culture and expectations of chivalry. When he ate meals with his father, the other knights, and the Lord of Coucy, they entertained themselves with stories of great deeds of chivalry. Some of them were their own deeds. How one of the knights had split an enemy's head in two with a single blow of his sword right through a steel helmet. How another had run through two men with a single thrust of his lance. How a third had unseated the most famous knight in France in a tournament joust. Another showed off the scar where a crossbow bolt had gone clean through the muscle of his right arm. But the man claimed it hadn't even stopped him from slaying four enemy knights with his left arm, not even his strong arm. Other stories belonged to the more or less distant past. One man's great-grandfather, a famous knight, had killed a dozen Saracens in Egypt during St. Louis' crusade a century before. Still other stories were entirely fictional, but also entirely in keeping with these themes. Arthurian tales were extremely popular. They embodied precisely these same values. Lancelot and Galahad and the whole bunch of them running around doing fantastic violence. The written word buttressed the oral culture of knighthood. Sometimes the knights read aloud from manuscripts containing more fictional works, like the Arthurian tales or the Song of Roland. These chansons de geste, literally songs of exploits, of deeds done, were extremely popular. Other tales contained in these manuscripts were chronicles or biographies of famous knights. All of these stories, no matter the medium or the content, prized deeds of skillful violence. Listen to this from the chanson called Gerard de Vienne. Quote, "Lords, will you hear a worthy tale I'll tell of lofty theme and deeds of great prowess? My son is not of pride or foolishness, neither of treason nor deceitfulness, but of a breed whom my Lord Jesus blessed, as fierce as any who ever yet drew breath." It goes on like this, quote, "When I see the whinnying war steeds plunge with worthy knights into a battle's crush, and see their spears and cutting blades well struck, there is nothing on earth I love so much." Messages like this surrounded our friend Jean as he grew up. When it came to violence, knights were a chatty and discerning bunch. They were connoisseurs and consumers. They savored individual strokes of a sword and thrusts of a lance in the same way that foodies talk about avocado toasts and sushi rolls past. The essence of these stories was straightforward. This culture valued skillful, brutal violence, all executed in the sight of one's peers in knighthood. If everybody saw it happen, then it was all the more meaningful. This was a big part of why heraldry, the combination of peculiar symbols like lions or fleur-de-lis or what have you that each knight or lord bore as his distinctive arms, was important. It was essential to distinguishing one man from the next and making sure credit went where it was due. If nobody saw some great deed happen, well, that was a thing that knights worried about quite a bit. The famous French knight Geoffroy de Charny, who wrote a long tract about chivalry right around this time, addressed precisely this problem. Well, it was tough luck, Charny wrote, but knights should always strive to be informed about the great feats of arms performed at any given place or time. Charny takes it for granted that the word of these great deeds will naturally spread. Charny goes on and talks about the kind of upbringing that our friend Jean would have experienced. Charny writes, quote, "As soon as they reach the age of understanding, and with their understanding they like to hear and listen to men of prowess talk of military deeds, and to see men-at-arms with their weapons and armor and enjoy looking at fine mounts and chargers. And as they increase in years, so they increase in prowess and in skill in the art of arms, in peace, and in war. And as they reach adulthood, the desire in their hearts grows ever greater to ride horses and to bear arms." As soon as they're able, according to Charny, the proper knight seeks out jousts, tournaments, and especially war. Quote, "They should immediately take up the practice of arms and war in order to achieve the highest honor and prowess," he writes. Now, Charny's portrait of the proper knight is idealized. There's no doubt about that. But he was speaking to an audience that would have recognized the outlines of this idealized portrait as something worth shooting for. The same was mostly true of the depictions of behavior that showed up in the chansons de geste or the biographical texts. This is what Jean grew up with. violence, well executed, was the foundational value of his life. The ability to do it effectively in sight of his peers was what marked Jean out as a member of this socially exalted group of warriors. As Richard Kuiper puts it, quote, "Knights were professional warriors who defined their status and place in the world by their right to bear and use arms." Jean's entire life was oriented around this basic reality. Now, this can easily sound reductive. Is violence all there was to being a knight? Is the stereotype of a pious, honorable knight completely wrong? No, absolutely not. Other values were absolutely present. Honor was indeed a key concept. So was piety. Winning the love of a worthy lady, another constant stereotype of medieval knights, was also tied into all of this. But this is where we need to confront our preconceptions about the meanings of these words. To a knight like Jean, honor wasn't some code of behavior with an objective existence. You didn't have honor because you adhered to this imagined system. No, to Jean, honor was social status. He had honor because he was a knight, because he exercised the privilege of doing violence. Honor and prowess were fundamentally intertwined. Shame, the opposite of honor, came from the inability or unwillingness to perform deeds of great prowess. Honor was physically won and maintained by valor in battle. Even love was tied into prowess. The pursuit of a worthy lady inspired a knight to perform great deeds, and a lady was honored by the love of a knight who had performed those great deeds. There were other elements to a knight's sense of honor, of course. Holding to one's sworn obligations, even in the face of great danger, was highly valued. There were other values, too. Loyalty to one's lord, to companions in arms, to a bond of love with a lady. Generosity. Knights were expected to give freely. This applied both to great lords who needed to reward worthy followers like Jean and to common knights like Jean himself. Piety, of course, was a foundational value. It melded in really interesting ways with the others. Finding ways to integrate a fundamentally violent profession with a deeply Christian medieval world wasn't exactly easy. Crusading provided an easy avenue, but by Jean's time in the 14th century, that had kind of dried up. Still, the idea that warfare might be religiously blessed bled outwards from crusading to knightly fighting more generally. If fighting pagans or Muslims was good, maybe fighting bad Christians was also good. If fighting bad Christians was good, maybe fighting itself wasn't too bad. Tons of medieval writers were happy to heap divine blessings on wars that had absolutely nothing to do with crusading. It's clear that knights felt the same. The last proposition in Geoffroy de Charny's tract on chivalry was entitled, quote, "A good man-at-arms can be pleasing to God." Our friend Jean was raised to believe exactly this, and he saw himself, of course, as a pious man. He prayed to God and the saints, and he asked for their blessing. If he was troubled by any contradictions between that piety and his vocation as a knight, well, it wasn't the act of fighting in itself that vexed him. It was much more likely to be Christian warnings against vainglory and pride that struck him as worth worrying about. This got at one of the core actual contradictions of chivalric culture. Honor, in the sense that Jean understood it, was about status. Even more, it was about the recognition of that status by a knight's peers. This emphasis on reputation and the pursuit of glory was fundamentally at odds with basic Christian precepts of humility, selflessness, and charity. Reformers and critics of chivalry constantly tried to reorient the knight's ideas of honor. They tried to point them toward virtue and service rather than individual pride and vainglory. But there was never really any easy way to square those competing priorities. It was an inherent contradiction, and it was built right into the structure of chivalric culture. Where piety and chivalry melded much more easily was around the idea of asceticism. Self-denial and the pursuit of the difficult life was a profoundly important Christian ideal throughout the Middle Ages. Physical suffering, according to this view, was inherently meritorious, was pleasing to God. As Kuiper points out, it's not hard to see how knights could easily fit into this broader cultural and religious paradigm. Monks suffered through their constraints on food and sleep, their long hours spent at prayer, their sexual abstinence. Knights suffered more directly. Charny writes, quote, "For whoever might want to consider the hardships, pains, discomforts, fears, perils, broken bones, and wounds which the good knights who uphold the order of knighthood as they should endure and have to suffer frequently, there is no religious order in which as much is suffered as has to be endured by these good knights who go in search of deeds of arms in the right way." So the active, strenuous life of a knight slid perfectly into these already existing channels. Christ had suffered on the cross, penance was suffering, and knights suffered in the course of their profession. All of this, from honor to loyalty to piety, ultimately comes back to prowess, to skill at arms and the performance of worthy deeds. When we recognize that as the central pillar of chivalry, everything else falls into place. And how was a knight to prove himself? This was a central concern for our friend Jean. The year is now 1345, and he's 15 years old. He spent his entire life drinking in these great tales from sources both historical and fictional, oral and written. He's imbibed the ideals of chivalry right alongside his practical training in horsemanship and arms. The combination of those two things tells him that deeds of prowess, preferably performed in front of an audience of his peers, are the key to furthering himself in the world. How is a relatively common knight like Jean supposed to do that? One answer was tournaments. These were organized competitions between knights, often put on by a great lord or a king to mark some important occasion. King Philip the Fair of France, we've talked about him a few times before, went so far as to ban all tournaments in his realm in 1312. That wasn't because he had a problem with tournaments. It was because he wanted to make sure that everybody showed up for the big tournament that he was planning to celebrate his son's knighting. Tournaments were where all the chivalric values came together in their most visible form. They were evidence of a lord's generosity, one of the core things that set apart the chivalrous from the common herd. They were opportunities to display status, the central concern of chivalric honor. Everybody got decked out in their best clothes, they carried the finest weapons, they rode their best horses. They were opportunities to win financial rewards, something we'll talk about more in just a bit. But most of all, they were a chance for knights to perform deeds of great prowess. In their initial phase, early in the 12th century, very little distinguished a tournament from actual combat. They were essentially mock battles, and as you'd expect, casualties were high. As the Middle Ages progressed, tournaments became a little more formalized, a little more separated from the actual practice of war. Jousting became one of the featured events, for example, as opposed to the savagery of the melee. But whether tournaments were more or less realistic, they served the same function for knights, an opportunity to perform their deeds in front of an audience and to prove their prowess. It wasn't enough to be skilled at arms. That skill constantly needed to be proved and to be recognized by other knights. A reputation for prowess was the cornerstone of chivalry. Tournaments were places to see and be seen, to prove that prowess to people whose opinions of it mattered. Moreover, they offered serious rewards. Money, prizes, the chance to catch the eye of a worthy lady. That last one was, in fact, often a reward. Romantic love between knights and ladies was a status marker. It was something that set them apart from the common herd of peasants and urban merchants. Beyond that, winning the love of the right lady, again, dependent on prowess, could mean the kind of marriage that would cement a knight's status for good. Tournaments offered the opportunity for a knight to win that kind of status, that honor, on many different levels. So, as Jean grew into his teenaged years, he attended tournaments with his father and the other knights of the Lord of Coucy's retinue. Eventually, as soon as the Lord of Coucy dubbed him a knight, Jean could participate himself. Jousting was his specialty, and he proved to be slick with the lance. He unseated a much older and more accomplished knight in his first tournament. The cheers of the crowd, the accolades of the Lord of Coucy's knights, and his father's approval were all music to Jean's ears. The Lord of Coucy gave him a fine pair of gilded spurs to mark the occasion. Jean used his winnings. The defeated knight had to pay him a formal ransom to purchase armor, a fine coat of mail, a helm, a steel breastplate. The young knight had gotten his first taste of what recognized prowess had to offer. But tournaments weren't the best route to a reputation for chivalry for young knights like Jean. War was a knight's occupation. It was the most direct path to the glorious proving of chivalry. Luckily, or unluckily, for Jean and his compatriots in chivalry, the mid-1340s had plenty of war to offer.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
In the summer of 1346, our friend Jean turned 16 years old. He had been knighted. He found success in his first tournament, where he won accolades from his fellow knights. But war was the knight's true proving ground, not the tournament. Jean was about to get his first taste of it. An English army led by King Edward III had landed in Normandy. It was burning its way toward Paris. The call went out from the French King Philip VI to form an army. The arrière-plan was a feudal summons to all the lords who owed the king service, and presumably all of those who owed those lords service. That included the Lord of Coucy, a man named Enguerrand VI, and by extension, Jean and his father. This was what knighthood and chivalry were all about, an army of men-at-arms gathering to fight a justified war against an invader. It was a chance for Jean to prove his prowess and get rich from loot and ransoming captured enemy knights. There was no contradiction here with the practice of chivalry. War was supposed to pay, and pay well. Now, in Charny's tract on chivalry, he lists the various kinds of deeds a knight can perform in order of their worth. First come deeds in tournaments, which are fine in the absence of anything better to do. Then come deeds of arms in local wars. Next are deeds performed in great conflicts at a distance, where a knight has to travel far and wide to make his mark. This certainly would have qualified in that last category. To do great deeds of chivalry in the presence of the highest lords of France and the king himself was the kind of opportunity, both in terms of status and material reward, that a young knight like Jean lived for. Now, sure, there were some contrary whispers that made Jean pause and think. Previous French armies had assembled only to fail to give battle at the last moment. King Philip VI wasn't renowned as a warrior. There were famous knights in the English army, he'd heard. But it was easy for Jean to push those anxieties down. To him, the French army felt like a grand tournament. He traveled with his father and the Lord of Coucy, but he met knights from all over France and beyond. There were Flemish speakers who followed the Count of Flanders. There were Czech-speaking Bohemians accompanying the blind King of Bohemia, John. Jean couldn't make head or tails of the Occitan language spoken by the knights from Languedoc in the south. There were Genoese crossbowmen in the army, too, but to Jean, they weren't worth paying attention to. No matter what language they spoke, these knights shared a remarkably similar outlook and culture. For that matter, if he'd been able to talk with them, Jean would have found much in common with the men-at-arms in the English army's encampment. All of them were set apart from the common herd by their prowess at arms. This gave them a measure of elite status, even if they were common knights like Jean. All of them knew how to handle a horse, a lance, and a sword. All of them wore much the same armor, and they carried much the same weapons. Practically all of them were bound to greater lords by ties of land and military service. They had read the same tales of chivalry and heard, if not exactly the same stories of prowess, the ones that hit on similar themes. Chivalry was a pan-European phenomenon. In the camp before the Battle of Crécy, Jean got a taste for that. Jean, his father, the other knights, and the Lord of Coucy awoke before dawn on the morning of August 26, 1346. They all prepared themselves for the fight they thought was coming. The English were close, they'd heard. Now, preparing was a long and involved process. On top of their undergarments, they wore a padded garment called a gambeson, which helped to absorb the shock of incoming blows. Above the gambeson went the hauberk, the coat of mail armor that reached down to the wearer's knees. Above that, a breastplate covered the torso, while steel gauntlets protected the hands. Other steel reinforcements covered the feet, shins, knees, and elbows. A helmet with a visor completed the suit of armor, but Jean didn't put that on just yet. A belt went around his waist, with a sword and dagger hanging down. It was already stifling and humid in the early morning sun when Jean swung himself up into the saddle. A squire handed him his lance and a triangular shield. In dribs and drabs, the French army was preparing itself to head up the road to fight the English. After a couple of hours in the saddle, Jean drank down a skin of water. His armor was hot to the touch. He was tired. But a rush of excitement went through his body when a group of knights on horseback appeared in the distance. The call went up and down the column of marching French. To arms. The English were near. Much of the infantry was still strung out behind them on the road, but what did it matter? The English were few, and the finest knights in France were all here. The sun rose to its highest point and then began to sink down as morning turned into afternoon. Shouts and yells filled the air as the French army wheeled into position. Steel-gray storm clouds gathered overhead. It was still hot and humid. Jean's undergarments were soaked through with sweat. They squelched every time he moved in the saddle. He sucked down water as fast as he could get it, and his mouth was still parched. Finally, Jean jammed his helmet down onto his head when he saw his father and the other knights do so. It couldn't be long now. They could see the English army gathered ahead of them on a gently sloping hillside. Droplets of rain started to fall from the sky. They pinged off Jean's helmet, and the sound melded with the pounding of his heart in his ears. Salty sweat ran down into his eyes, peering out through the slit in his visor. His lance and shield were heavy in his hands. Horses whinnied and neighed all around him. He saw the Genoese crossbowmen in front of him advance up the slope toward the English. Then he heard the shrill whine of hundreds of arrows cut them to pieces. The Genoese ran backward. Cowards, Jean thought. Kill the traitors, he heard someone yell. The knights around him surged forward. He saw one of the Lord of Coucy's knights spit a fleeing Genoese on the end of his lance. Jean wasn't sure what was happening. Everything was confusion. He and the other knights were galloping toward the English line in a dense, packed-together mass. Hooves thundered. He heard the whine of arrows again, and then he saw the result. Two struck the knight in front of him and threw him backward out of the saddle. His ears rang as an arrow glanced off his helmet. Horses screamed in pain and whinnied, pitching their riders to the ground. It was all Jean could do to swerve around fallen men and terrified horses. His father was still beside him. He could see the Lord of Coucy just ahead. They were almost to the English lines now, a solid mass of dismounted, heavily armored men waiting for them. Jean lowered his lance and spurred his horse on. There was a sickening crash, a sound like nothing Jean had ever heard, as the French knights slammed into the English line. Jean's arm felt like it was going to rip out of the socket when his lance punched into the shield of an English man-at-arms and then splintered. He ripped his sword from the scabbard and laid into the English. Steel clashed on steel with resounding clangs. Cries of Saint George, Saint Denis filled the air. To his left, he saw the Lord of Coucy fall from his horse and then disappear down into a sea of bodies. He and his father desperately tried to make their way over to their lord, but the press of bodies was too much. Jean's horse reared. He fell from the saddle. He barely avoided a swinging poleaxe taking his head off. That was the last thing Jean remembered clearly. He recalled stabbing an Englishman through the leg with his sword and then losing his shield. He knew he'd ripped an enemy man-at-arms visor off and then stabbed down through the open slot. Everything else was gone. The adrenaline and exertion wiped out his memories. The next thing he knew, he and his father were limping backward across the field. They were picking their way through the mounds of dead and dying horses and men. Both were covered in cuts and bruises. Cheers came up from the English lines. The battle was over, and Jean had lost. What had gone wrong? It's easy to blame chivalry for this disaster of a battle at Crécy, to contrast the French gentlemen amateurs with unrealistic ideas about how to fight with the disciplined and professional English. Chivalry did indeed play a role in the French defeat. King Philip VI couldn't simply avoid giving battle in the face of an English army. Remember, the king was also a knight. He was deeply embedded in this chivalric culture. How could he not fight when the enemy was right there? Philip VI was not a successful warrior king with a reputation for competence and prowess. He had no cultural leeway, so to speak. The French knights like Jean weren't particularly disciplined. There's no arguing that. But that's poor generalship and poor planning, not some deep-seated problem with the underlying ideology. In fact, the English king Edward III was every bit as embedded in chivalric culture as the French knights like Jean were, maybe even more so. Edward had a reputation for putting on the best tournaments in Europe. His son, the Black Prince, was no different. They didn't stop thinking in chivalric terms just because they won. If anything, they would have said that they proved their prowess with their victories, not that they were behaving unchivalrously. And that was the crux of the matter. Knights were not honor-bound amateurs. They could be better or worse at winning, but that was a matter of skill, talent, and experience, not cultural imperatives. We've met Geoffroy de Charny several times today. Charny was widely acknowledged to be the finest, most chivalrous knight in France, maybe in all of Europe. He literally wrote a book on the subject. And yet, Charny was also happy to try to bribe a castle commander into handing the place over instead of taking it in open combat. Charny had no problem with ravaging the countryside, with looting and burning in service to military aims. Taking money for military service was perfectly fine by Charny too. He didn't look down his nose at mercenary knights, though he was surely aware of the social distance separating him and other knights from common archers or infantry. Plundering with abandon was perfectly okay with Charny as long as it didn't interfere with a man-at-arms' responsibilities. Knights occasionally expressed some regret over looting or burning churches, but never consistently enough to think that even that, the lowest possible bar, was forbidden by some code of behavior. Our friend Jean survived the disaster at Crécy, unlike many of his compatriots in chivalry. More calamities would follow, including the cherry on top, the Battle of Poitiers in 1356. That was where Geoffroy de Charny was killed, along with much of the rest of the flower of French nobility. Let's say Jean survived that one, too. By 1360, Jean was 30 years old. He had spent almost half his life as an active knight, most of it in genuine, ongoing war. If he had managed to survive, it's safe to assume that Jean would have been quite a skilled knight with a deep well of experience. If we could sit down with Jean at that point and ask him about chivalry, about the way he thought about the world, what would he have said? Well, he would not have seen the failures of French knighthood as an indictment of chivalry itself. Very much the opposite. He, like Charny and other commentators, would have pointed to the failings of knights themselves rather than the underlying ideals. Too much fine food and fancy clothing had made them soft and unaccustomed to the rigors of war. They were weak and cowardly. They were ill-disciplined and didn't take orders. They were too prideful and too obsessed with their reputations, with how they were perceived, rather than with the deeds themselves. Some of that was nonsense at best or self-flagellation at worst. Other pieces had some basis in fact. Jean thought often about the sight of the Lord of Coucy dragged from his horse at Crécy. Should he and his father have tried harder to fight their way toward their lord, even at the cost of their lives? Should he have died at Poitiers like Geoffroy de Charny? That's survivor's guilt, with some extra bite from deep-seated chivalric ideas of prowess and physical courage. The pieces about discipline and pride had more grounding in fact. The individualistic drive for reputation through deeds of arms could be at odds with sound military practice. From Jean's perspective, though, the solution to that was balance, or what medieval knights called mesure. Prowess, pride, seeking after glory, but avoiding excess. The answer wasn't the rejection of chivalry, but tempering its fundamental drives to avoid disaster. Sure enough, that's what we see with French knights in the phase of the war that saw so many French victories in the late 1360s and the 1370s. Knights like Jean, already battle-hardened, had learned harsh lessons about the realities of war. Chivalric imperatives didn't disappear. They just acquired a hard shell of practical experience. For Jean and his compatriots, men like his new lord, Enguerrand de Coucy, the subject of Barbara Tuchman's great book, A Distant Mirror, or Bertrand de Guesclin, that experience made them savvy campaigners. They knew how to raid and burn, how to besiege a castle, how to set an ambush, how to deal with unscrupulous free companies of mercenaries. Killing peasants and making off with livestock, all the nasty business of the Hundred Years' War, was perfectly compatible with chivalry. They just got better at it. Our friend Jean spent his entire adult life fighting exactly that war.
Even as French knights were riddled with the arrows from English longbowmen, there was no crisis of chivalry in the late Middle Ages. It changed, to be sure. That perfect fusion between ideology and function, chivalric ideals, landholding, military service, that did break. But chivalry itself remained. It was a powerful driver of behavior and expectations. In fact, chivalry took on its highest form in the dark days of the 15th century. Glittering courts, especially those of the Dukes of Burgundy and Edward IV of England, showcased the finest displays of chivalric ideals. The jousts had never been better. The knights had never been more capable of deeds of great prowess. Chivalry even survived into the early modern period. Nobles never lost that sense of military responsibility. They served in droves in the armies of the Italian Wars in the 16th century, either as individual soldiers or mercenary captains. It's really striking when you read 16th century military memoirs just how much they resemble the chivalric biographies of the 14th century. They're full of adventure, of daring deeds of prowess, performed with the expectation of material and social reward. The values are basically the same. At least in this case, there was no sharp break that separated the medieval from the early modern. Chivalry was a durable and lasting value system for a military aristocracy. When we drill down to what medieval people thought chivalry actually was, a lot of the things that seem contradictory to our modern expectations disappear. There was no rigid code of behavior like the Ten Commandments to make up the core of chivalry. Instead, it was prowess, the performance of skillful deeds of arms for an audience of a knight's peers. That was the core. Everything else about being a knight was tied into that in some way. Honor? It wasn't an ethical concept, but it was one of social status defended with violence. A knight's piety was rooted in the performance of physical deeds, of war, with God's blessing. Even the pursuit of worthy ladies was connected to prowess. There were no strong prohibitions on looting, burning, rapine, and pillage. Ambushes were perfectly fine. So was paid service. So was getting rich through war. At heart, knights were warriors. Deeds of arms were what chivalry was fundamentally concerned with. But if the contradictions we might have expected to see aren't really there, others do appear. How were knights supposed to reconcile their laser focus on reputation and great deeds with admonitions against vainglory? How could military discipline and focus coexist with pride and individual achievement? If both sides of a war claimed that God blessed their chivalry, who was right? If knights lost in a battle, what was wrong with their performance of chivalry? These were the things that knights and those who talked about knights argued over. Those were real contradictions, but they were contradictions that belonged to medieval people, not to us. Next time on Tides of History, we'll be heading to the very opposite end of the social spectrum. We're going to talk about peasants, about what their lives were like and why they mattered. We'll also be talking about something chivalrous knights were terrified of, peasant rebellions. I've got a very important reminder here. We are taking your questions for our question and answer episode. You can send them to the show on Twitter at Tides History. You can send them to our Facebook page, Tides of History. Or you can send them to my producer, Leah, on Twitter at Leah Goes Where via direct message. Make sure that you send them in by Friday, August 17th. Until then, thank you so much for joining me here. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Jeff Schmidt. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. The producer is Leah Sutherland. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some, But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.